over the course of the week, that you'll at least have time to read the chapter. But today you did it already, hopefully. And Rabbi Levine's long discussion of his hypothetical case, and Mr. Katz's PowerPoint. And then there can be other summaries if you want to read. Also, we'll put up, there'll be a, yes.
It was Mr. Katz's PowerPoint in the badge, so I don't think
that. It wasn't there? Okay, so we'll make sure we'll get
I'll email it out to everyone.
Thank you, Chrissy.
Okay, so what was in the, we had Roy Zachter, and we had, what else did we have in the bag?
We had Zachter, we had Tamari, we had Levine.
Okay, so those three of the, there's also a Hebrew one by Shalom Bar Hafstig, but can do without. But I think the other things that would be helpful, which I haven't figured out yet how we're going to do it. So tomorrow I want to do it with Moshe and Shir. And then probably one of the other days I want to go through everything cited by the Pesukei Teshuva. At least one long Sif Katana of the Pesukei Teshuva. And then there is a work called the Pitchei Choshen, which is a contemporary summary, which is... Pardon?
Do you have it?
Which I have. It's on Hebrew Books.
It's on Hebrew Books?
It's on Hebrew Books.
So interesting.
It's on Hebrew Books. So, that's, so I can just give you the page numbers. Hebrew book. So that's really, really long and massive, so I don't know that that's fair to put as Makarot, but that's really probably more valuable than anything I can add after today, although I do want to talk about Rav Moshe and... So today, in my part, I want to go through the Rama. I want to find out what you thought the Rama was doing. And you already read the historical context, so I don't have any chiddush in that regard. So the question is, to what extent does the history and the subsequent history change your evaluation of what the Rama said? How do you relate to what the Rama said in light of what he wrote in the Shulchan Aruch? And where does that leave us? Okay, so we'll start with the Rama. So the Rama starts with a sugya of the Sheva Mitzvos, which is a very, very odd way to start a tshuva about Jews. Right? And if you didn't know the case in advance, you would look at it and say, wow, that's a really, really weird way to start a tshuva about Jews. No?
Well,
you figure it's not really about Jews. Right? It's not really about Jews. So who is it really about?
It's about this other printer.
So now the question is, this is a challenge I'm dealing with in the case we have also. Right? The challenge is, what happens if you have a court case, and you think that, right? And not everyone has accepted your jurisdiction, so you have to claim to have jurisdiction over everybody, but in order for your verdict to work, you have to figure out whom you can impose it on that will listen to you. Yes, Avi?
What he does here is he really admits that he has no jurisdiction, and the last stage is to say, this is how you need to force the Jews themselves to follow this rule.
Yes, so he doesn't have jurisdiction over he doesn't have practical jurisdiction over the non-Jew.
Okay, he does have practical jurisdiction, he doesn't have actual jurisdiction.
No, those are the same. Right. There's theoretical jurisdiction.
Yes.
He doesn't have practical jurisdiction. What he ends up saying is that he admits that I have no way to enforce this, and so I need to tell you why this is a fee on the buyers themselves. And
yes.
He says, and anyone who doesn't follow this is a fan.
So he pulls a trick, right? So the trick he pulls is that since the non-Jew is doing something wrong, right, therefore the Jews, right, cannot participate in the wrongdoing the non-Jew is doing. Right, that's his move. That's a pretty wild move.
Straightforward. Well, it's wild in that if we were dealing with the real court system, you would never have a ruling that worked that way. But in the reality he's facing, in which someone has asked him to rule on a case a thousand miles, very far away, in which he has no ability to enforce, his only way to do it is to turn to the people themselves and say, you're dead if you don't listen to me.
Why do you think this would never happen in a quote-unquote real Beit Din?
Presumably a real Beit Din has the power to enforce. Otherwise, it's not a real Beit Din. I'm playing with words.
I mean, let's say, for example, let's suppose I really think that your country should not support international terrorism.
Yeah.
So I can't stop you from engaging in international terrorism, but I can say, all right, everyone in my country is not allowed to trade with you.
Right.
So how is that different?
How is that different?
Yeah.
Civil matter
requires there might be an assumption that you have jurisdiction over something. A local Beitin would have jurisdiction over people who are in the area.
But it never does over non-Jews.
He's also telling every Jew everywhere. He's not just saying, it's like, this is as if you were saying to the citizens of the country that you're trying to attack, but economically, you are also not allowed to trade with yourself. See?
I trade with yourself.
I also don't, like,
yeah.
Yeah. It's that it's also you're trying to, in a real economic case,
yeah,
a Beitin would be able to say, you have to stop selling, you have to recall your item, and we're going to force you, we're going to send in the police if you don't, we're going to go out and check. He doesn't have the ability to enforce such a thing.
Right.
And so he has to, his only recourse is to create an addition, is this additional set of rules to say, those of you who would buy it are obligated not to.
Right, but is this not the exact same thing as sanctions against Iran?
Is it not the exact, I think it's different because it's like, this is, it's...
Why is it different? The international legal system also does have the capacity.
It's legislation as opposed to the court's ruling.
It's legislation.
I mean, that's a cop-out. That's legislation. Like, we can legislate sanctions, which enjoin companies and people from doing business.
Yeah.
And then that's new law. This is him saying, this is the law.
So you're just running into the same problem.
That's a cop-out. I don't really see why that, what the... Are you trying to say that there are judicial schemes that work in this fashion?
Yes.
Of keeping people from doing it?
I think that when you have a verdict, and you know what the right thing to do is, and then you have to figure out a way that the verdict will be implemented, and if not all the parties involved are going to accept your jurisdiction, so you have to find a way in which you can both be fair, right? You don't want to impose unfair burdens on the people who accept your jurisdiction, but you want to find a way in which the parties under your jurisdiction are the ones who can carry it out.
I don't think sanctions are a good parallel. I just don't think there's a good parallel here. I think the point is brought a case to the Supreme Court of Ireland, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
The Supreme Court of Ireland wanted to have some impact on a company that sat in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, all of you Kansans have the moral obligation not to do any business with that company in Kansas.
All of you I see. Okay. So that's
anybody, anywhere, any Kansan anywhere in the United States, and any Irish person anywhere, can't do business with that one. So
any Irish person?
Any person anywhere. They're creating he's creating a moral obligation.
So let's suppose here we are sitting in Boston.
Yes.
Right, and we wish to stop the outsourcing of jobs to China.
Yes.
And someone brings a lawsuit against Disney.
Yes.
Because Disney has, right, because Disney is thinking of outsourcing its tech support people to China.
Okay.
And so the court can't tell China to stop because China won't care. So the court will say that unless Disney ceases this practice, then nobody should call Disney for tech support. And if you call Disney for tech support, then you're in violation of the right of our temporary restraining order.
That case occur. That court could tell Disney, that court either can tell Disney you're in violation of the law by shipping things out to China, we're going to shut down your entire business, or they can't do anything. Since when can the law create a personal obligation not to do business with people? The only way we have that in this country is union is picket lines. And people feel the moral sense that I want to cross a picket line.
Uh-huh.
That's not a judicial decision. That's people pressuring one another. I can't think of a good parallel. You're trying to say that a sanctions regime created by a legislature is a good parallel to this sort of international pseudo-law case. Not that it isn't law, but it's not in the same sense that we have international courts which can enforce themselves through police and through the executive. They have executive power backing them up. There is no other legal system that works that way, except perhaps for the International Court of Justice. That's maybe a better parallel. A country can bring a case to the International Court of Justice, or whatever it's called in The Hague, and they can sue, and then they can say, okay, go out and arrest that person. The other countries say, we don't want to arrest that person. And so you have heads of governments who go around all over the place and they never get arrested. That's the parallel. It's for that international court to say anybody who lets that person in should be shunned. That's like what the Iran is doing.
Yes. Doesn't work so well, though.
Right.
Yes, let me know.
Part of it, I'm not sure how much it really makes a difference, but this only applies to the consumer, like, only Jews are going to buy a copy of the Rambam. But hypothetically, there is a. This is open. The market is still open to sell it, except to Jews. So it's not really a total boycott, even though you are effectively telling everybody who would ever buy a copy to boycott.
Hmm. Does he see this as international, or does he see it as? Does he see there being more than two groups, Jews and non-Jews?
At this point, no. I'm not either.
Right. Yeah.
He does say that the Cherem really only applies to the people in his land, at least in the end. So that's because that might be the only way he has jurisdiction and feels okay to do that. So that it does seem to be a bit different, at least in the practical realm, between Cherem and...
Okay, so what you might have is that you have somebody who feels very, very strongly about what the result ought to be and may not have the tools at his disposal to accomplish what needs to be accomplished and is trying for all sorts of measures. But it's a really interesting choice to figure out. So the opening problem is, that you have the Aram Katzin Ellenbogen, Aram Padua, and he's going to go broke. Despite having invested his work and his money in this realm, he's going to go broke because a non-Jew is doing something. So what are the consequences of that? What are the consequences of saying that we have nothing to say? Every time a Jew puts out an edition, a non-Jew can pirate it and put it out for a gold coin less?
No one will publish it.
Right, so he has that. So we should raise the question of whether this is only the Aram Katzin Ellenbogen, or whether he's fundamentally looking at the enterprise of Jewish printing being driven out of business. Yes, Tim.
I think it's really important that the other guy isn't Jewish. This is like, I'd argue that this is a case of protecting a Jew against. Protecting a Jew's livelihood, masquerading as a competition case.
Okay, so that's a fair...
I don't think this is about Jewish printing.
But even if you had a fellow Jew coming and taking the work, it still would it would have the same effect of no one wanting to put any time into anything because someone could always come along and steal it.
That's right. Right? So we'd have to solve it for a Jew, but we know how to solve it if it's a Jew.
Right.
The problem is if we give up in this case, this is a case where the Jewish and the non-Jewish economies have become intertwined, that non-Jewish competition can be ruinous.
Right.
Right. So that's a whole interesting question. What happens if non-Jews can just compete with Jews and there's nothing we can do about it because we don't have a tight enough community anymore and the market is international?
Do we know? I mean, I didn't finish the article. The last time did this work?
No. really not. Right, quite disastrous, yes.
I wonder if the case here is a sober analysis of the reality of Jews in the world.
Yeah.
Which is that we will always be in a minority and we will always be at the hands of government.
Well, not in the state of Israel.
I mean, in a globalized world, we are always. So, I mean, the question is, I feel like I read it, like, the tone is like one of resignation. Like,
you think the Ramaz tone is one of resignation?
More of the case, the analysis of the text.
Yes.
Oh, that's why that article was good. One of the interesting things about that article was to say that American copyright law, at least, is much stronger, and we're clearly protecting our own Padua.
Yeah, no, I think that's. I think that is certainly the case. That what he, I think basically the thesis is that Halacha doesn't have a copyright law, and not having a copyright law was not a big deal when printing wasn't a major, before printing. But once you have printing, all of a sudden copyright law becomes a really big deal, and their halacha is without the tools to deal with it. And then we can say, all the more so, right? So what do we do if we accept Rabbi Blank's position? I understand Rabbi Wiener's position also that halacha simply has no tools to deal with intellectual property, so that just doesn't work.
Rabbi Wiener says dina de malchut de dina.
Okay.
Which works in the 21st century American case much better than...
So what we can say is... So one of the methods of dealing with the failure of Kosher Mishpat is to say, well, look, there are always going to be two things. Either A, we're going to be under some government, so Dina Malchus Adina, or Mashiach will come, in which case we'll make Takanos. Right? Both of those basically concede that Kosher Mishpat is a failure.
Wait, sorry, how does that work?
And then we'll make Takanos, right? We'll just redo Halakha from scratch.
Okay. Okay.
You know, Sanhedrin can come in and, like, overrule.
Yeah, Sanhedrin, whatever it takes, right? But we'll, right? Right. Whatever it comes, but we just, basically it's a concession. Halacha is that the project of adapting halacha to the reality we have, right? Saying dina malchus adina is they're both versions of deus ex machina, right? The natural way the world fails, and we just have to hope for something supernatural coming off stage and saving us. And the problem with dina malchus adina is what happens if it's a terrible dina malchus adina? What happens if it's an evil dina malchus adina? Right? Then we have nothing to say, though. We can ignore it, but we have nothing left to say. It's one thing if Dina Malchus Adina is an alternate to a good system. But if Dina Malchus Adina is an alternate to chaos, or nothing.
Why can't you accept the concept of Takanos now? Meaning, why can't you have a Takanos Akal? Okay, so you need the call to accept it. Right, like that's always going to be a problem in Kosher Mishpat.
Right, so we could say that what I'm pointing out as a flaw is not really a flaw, but is not intended to function like other areas of law, even to the extent we could debate how much other areas of halakha are supposed to function that way. But Choshen Mishpat Dafka was never expected to function as a fixed set of laws without constant legislative updating. It was supposed to be responsive to economic reality, and so the flaw in our system is, right, it's not a new thing, it's that Choshen Mishpat always was supposed to be updated. And the flaw is that we have been waiting for Mashiach. We shouldn't wait for Mashiach. There's really no reason to. Let's just let's find a way to revive Choshen Mishpat through some accepted body.
So, what was the original attempt of Choshen Mishpat? I'm confused.
The original attempt of Choshen Mishpat was to create a functioning body of law for the society that it dealt with, and to have it updated regularly. And we failed to update it regularly.
Is that like an accepted?
I don't know. I'm attributing it to Yesh, so I'm assuming it's from.
Sorry.
Ali, what do you want to say?
This is more really a question, because I saw cited over the weekend an idea of Rav Shimon Shkab, about something called Ma'arechet Mishpatim, that exists sort of parallel but in tandem with Halacha when it comes to Kosher Mishpat especially. And it sounded like, from the way it was quoted, that he has an idea that is sort of like a upgraded version of Dina Nebakuta, which is like, there exists this thing, it's real, even if it isn't halakha.
What does that mean?
That it's like, it's not just a deus, it's like saying Dina Nebakuta, Dina copyright law exists, it's that it's not a deus ex machina, because the system recognizes it as a real sort of complement.
If we are living in, let's suppose that, I don't know, 5 Jews and 45 non-Jews are marooned stateless, right, marooned in Somalia. Right? There's no Dina Malkusa.
Okay.
And one of them writes a book.
Mm-hmm. They call it Dina Malkusa.
Is it Dina Malkusa? There's no Malkusa.
Right.
So according to Shimon Shkaf, what happens?
I have no idea.
Okay, so that's what I want to know, right? Does Allah have anything to say if it happens to be stuck in an environment where there is no external force to replace it?
It sounds like it might have more to do with an idea of natural law.
So we can try and claim that there is, right, so that's a whole, right, and Rav Shimon Shkaf is famous for, right, for having some kind of notion of some kind of parallel law, and this is usually where people will start quoting the Ran about Mishpat HaMelech, and talk about, all right, so let's talk about the fundamental theological challenge. Right, the fundamental theological challenge, as in every system, is can you reduce halakha to principles, and you can reduce halakha to principles, so what happens if A, halakha is not accomplishing those principles, or B, you're in a space where halakha doesn't have authority, do those principles have any power? Right, is there any way in which we can say there is a Jewish value of X, if the Jewish value of X is not currently embodied in halakha, and is a value of any enforceability? Yes, Joshua.
So I'm currently thinking about this in terms of a man for all seasons,
mm-hmm.
where there's God's law, which Thomas More wants to follow, but he feels like he can't really take action that is unless it's justified by human law, to the extent of letting the devil run free. Because even though God's law would have him catch the devil, but to do so would require breaking human law, and once you've set those extraordinary bonds loose. Now there's nothing to hold you on to the real anymore.
Right, so this is right. So you become antinomian, right? You start quoting. You start talking about Averi Lishma and going to the root of your neshama, right? And all sorts of things like this, right?
Well, when all the winds of England blow, there's no one. There's nothing to stop you.
So I think that there's. That is always the risk of natural law in a legal system.
Once you've cut down every law.
Yes, Jenna.
I mean, isn't he essentially making a claim that, like, the non-Jewish law has to fit into Halakha in a certain way, right?
Has to fit into.
That, like, Dina Makhluta Dina doesn't, but in this case, the, like, law of the land is wrong because it's not following these laws which we are prescribing for it, right?
Okay, so let's be right. He is not trying Dina Malchus Adina to fit in, right? He's making a much more radical claim, which is that the Dina Malchus Adina is bound by Halacha.
Right. And thus, in this case, Dina Malchus Adina, then we don't follow it because it's not fitting Halacha the way it's supposed.
Okay, so that's great, right? He doesn't go down this path. He's not willing to say, well, we don't have anything to say about copyright. Let's see what they have to say about copyright. He assumes we have sin to say he can impose it. So let's follow his argument through. So we have the Gemara in Sanhedrin, right, which begins with a statement, Sheva mitzvah Noach, and derives them all from the Pasuk of Yitzav. And Rav Yitzchak comes along and he reverses what is derived from Yitzav and Elohim. Right? And his question is, Why doesn't the Gemara bothers to ask what's the difference between Rav Chista and Rav Yitzchak Bar Avdimi about the Makor of Avodah Zarah? Why doesn't the Gemara also ask about the Makor of Dinim? Right? Isn't there an Achkamina in terms of the Makor of Dinim? And right, and his answer, which is always the answer when the Gemara doesn't ask a question, what's the answer?
It was
obvious. Right. That's why he did, right. That's why we didn't ask the question. We didn't ask the question because it was obvious. It was Barur Kashamish Patsaharayim. Yes, Avinu.
Wait, what do you think that he's asking why we're asking not on Dinim? I thought the question was why don't we ask on the Machloket Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yitzchak?
Right, which is about
I mean, we have two series of drashas.
Well, he asked about Avodah Zarah first, yes, pardon? Yeah, we two series where it could be more precise than I am, yes?
Meaning, it's like a tree of drushes. We have Rabbi Yochanan, who is Dorish, Vayitzav to Dinim, and Hashem to, and Elohim to Avodah Zarah. And then we have Rabbi Yitzchak, who says Vayitzav to Avodah Zarah and Elohim to Dinim.
Right.
And then we have, subsequently, Rav Chista and Rabbi Yitzchak disagreeing about what the connection is, Vayitzav, between Vayitzav and Avodah Zarah, which is within the opinion of Rabbi Yitzchak. And then the Rama asks, why didn't they ask what the difference is between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yitzchak?
In terms of Avodah Zarah, precisely, more before he gets to Dina. Yes, better than I would. Okay, good. And so what's his answer? If that's the question, what's the answer?
Right, because it's obvious what the difference is.
Yes, and what is the obvious difference?
The difference is that Rabbi Yochanan thinks that the mitzvah of Bnei Noach are a conventional law outside of the Torah, and that you just have to follow whatever law there happens to be. Whereas for Rabbi Yitzchak, the mitzvah of Bnei Noach are sort of a subset of Torah, and therefore they have to follow Torah laws as part of that.
Okay, how do we get that for the drushas?
Yeah, it's depending on what the Gezeira Sheva is from. Meaning, if it's from Avraham, then it's sort of a conventional law. And then if it's from the Psukim of the Nikra Balabayit, so that's specifically post.
Okay, so right. So the question of whether Vayitzav is Avodah Zarah or Dinim, right? Or Elohim is Dinim. So if Elohim is Dinim, that comes from Nikra Balabayit Elohim, and that's post Sinai. And if Vayitzav is Dinim, then it's Avraham. And that must be pre-Sinai. So there's a fundamental, right? So there's a fundamental machlokas as to whether the mitzvah of dinim that non-Jews are obligated in is pre-Sinai or post-Sinai, and then we bracket the problem of Abraham keeping Erev Tavshilin Alright.
Because nobody else can.
So, sorry, can we just outline where we open them? I mean, the pre-post seem it, but they're saying something more than that, right?
So the claim is that if you learn Dinim from by an analogy to a pasuk, which is pre-Sinai,
right.
then you must think that Dinim have no necessary relationship to halacha as we have it. Because halacha pre-Sinai had no necessary relationship to halacha as we have it. It's more like Mitzvot Bei Noach.
This is very much against the Rambam's version of Shem Mitzvot Bei Noach.
Why do you think it's against the Rambam?
Because the Rambam makes it very clear that the requirement of the chiyuv of Shem Mitzvot Bei Noach, or rather, that you only are Mekayim Shem Mitzvot Bei Noach as a non-Jew
because it was commanded by Sinai, yes.
Right.
That wild Rambam. I don't know what to do with that Rambam. I wrote about it once, but I don't know what to do with that Rambam.
I think it's because he wants to, it's part of his project to bolster Moshe's prophecy.
Okay, it's part of the project, it still doesn't make sense. Yes, Ellie.
Do you mind defining what Dinim is?
What?
Do you mind defining what Dinim is for the purposes of this?
Dinim appears, for our purposes, to be the mitzvah non-Jews have to establish functional court systems sufficient to establish a civil society.
So is it monetary, is it civil, is it criminal, what is
all
that?
Of it.
It's very general. Is that like, it sounds very general.
Civilization.
It's the Rambam. Shem.
There's a point where it seems to be talking about Dinim as separate from, like, as outside of the Sheva Mitzvot.
No, Dinim is one of the Sheva Mitzvot.
So then what does it mean to the whole Sidule and Dinim, the Sheva
Where are we?
On the next page. It's what?
It's about the Ten Commandments. There's seven, and then there's plus three that are for us.
Right.
And the Aser
HaDibra. Those plus three are for us. But the Aser HaDibra. What's
no
small?
No.
Sorry.
There's
a
Havamina.
Okay. Either way, my question is, what does he mean there? That's different?
Right.
So where are we?
There's a real Havamina.
No, it's
on the next
page.
It's a
Shita.
Right, so that's the Gemara says. That's the contradiction. I think we're answered. That's the contradiction. Is what about Dina was already pre-commanded? Right, and the answer is Adav Adim Hasra, right?
The answer is that it's a different Shita. The ultimate answer is a different Shita. The attempted answer is Adav Adim Hasra. We reject
that. Yeah, sorry. The final answer is Tanav Ibn Asher takes out Dinan Berkes Hashem and puts in Sirus and Kilayim. Which is also a really weird position.
But it makes a lot of sense with the Ramban that says Kilayim's not messing up the natural order.
Yeah, I was wondering that.
Okay, the problem is you end up, if you take out Dinim, then you lack an enforcement mechanism. So you still have to have an implicit Dinim, because unless you think they have no obligation.
No, unless you think Dinim just means Dinim Amenos.
So the world is just supposed to be chaotic?
No, there's an assumption that society will set up societies.
There's an assumption that society will set up societies, and we don't.
And this is a prerequisite of what those societies are supposed to do.
So, the question is, right, do you have to set up. The position of Tanav Ibn Asher appears to be that Bnei Noach have no mitzvah of dinim.
Correct.
So, what is supposed to happen in society? Whatever happens?
Whatever society decides, so long as it follows the
democracy,
the seven mitzvot Bnei Noach.
A democracy with a constitution,
or a dictatorship. I don't see why someone couldn't get up, and if everyone listens to him, everyone listens.
Everyone listens. You're already in essentially democracy.
Well, no, I'm saying if he makes everyone listen by force of death, so then he makes everyone listen by force. I'm saying every dictator, by that definition, every dictatorship is a democracy.
No, if everyone listens. Okay, so if you use force.
Such time as they're not in a state of active civil war.
You think that that way halacha just doesn't care about how civil society is ordered?
Yeah.
Okay. Could be. Yes, there
we go. Well, even for those, even when we say that the dinim that the Bnei Israel receive at Mara are the specifics of the judicial system, so that would imply, dinim becomes like a meta mitzvah. It's a way of ensuring that the other mitzvot are kept. It doesn't, for our purposes, we don't really care how they're going to keep it. It could be with one din, it could be with one aid. It doesn't, we don't hold it to the same standards. So even for those who hold that there's dinim, it's pretty amorphous.
It is very amorphous. It is very, very, right? We don't have any idea, really, what, and the question is, do we want to put any content to it or not? So the Ramah is kind of radical in that he puts, right, so he says that the Rambam says that they only, that the mitzvah dinim applies only to the Sheva Mitzvahs. So of course the Ramban says the Sheva Mitzvahs is everything basically that we have, right, outside of ritual. So that doesn't solve so much. Yes, Heller?
I'm just like thinking in terms of the other, of all the Sheva Mitzvahs in general.
Yeah.
The other six have like there are certain parameters for how they operate. Gilei Arayos, Shfichas Damim, we know what those things are.
Yes.
But like, would Oliver Wendell Holmes know what the Edom is like when he sees it?
Wasn't Oliver, it was Powell.
I don't know what.
It was Powell who knew
it. No, it's like, but you know, like, it's just to, like, so how does it fit into the other Sheva Mitzvahs?
So it depends. So the Rambam has a nice solution, and the Rambam's solution is the minimum only applies to the other mitzvot, right? It's just it's an enforcing mechanism, right? It's like Congress shall have the power to make all laws, right? That are relevant to that. So the Rambam really throws in the one important line here, which he says that doesn't matter because of anidon l'shel l'fanenu shehu hagezel v'echad n'shel mitzvot l'hem. So he moves it in, and he says that the case in question falls under theft. Right? That's on the third line of the paragraph beginning with Afkia Rambam on page 2. I forgot the first name, page number to get in there. Because I'll tell Brana to put page numbers on.
Just, you should make a template that has page numbers in it already.
Yes, templates, that would be helpful. Okay. So his first move is simply to say that this is Gezel, and his second move is to say that the mitzvah of dinim is bound by the details of our law. How many of you found that claim convincing? His second claim, right? His first claim is that this is Gezel, and his second claim is that the definition of Gezel for non-Jews has to be the same as we reach halachically.
I very much don't agree with the second one.
I think the second claim works much better if you buy his reading of the Gemara that if all halacha is really no, but doesn't work if it's anything else.
What do you mean if you're reading the Gemara, all halacha is Shem
and Tzvinoach? What we had at Sinai is...
I'm not following.
Right, the more expansive reading that he suggests, uh-huh, based on the Gemara, is about...
Okay, so if we paskin that dinim is right, if we paskin that their mitzvah dinim is learned from us,
yeah.
So not right. So the Mela, the Mitzvah Dinim, must be the same as ours. Yes, Supreme.
I'm much more inclined to buy that claim than I am to buy that this is Gezel. Why is this Gezel?
Much more inclined to buy the other claim.
Because he copied and sold as something else somebody's original work.
That's not theft. He didn't steal the original part. Why?
Yes, he did. He worked.
Intellectual property doesn't exist.
Okay, but we're still.
I'm a scientist. If someone steals my data that I worked on hard. That's stealing what
that
I did.
That you were selling freely to the public?
All right. Judah, what do you want to say?
I don't necessarily understand what the practical uses of saying that a goy is doing gezel according to us because the goy is just saying, I'm not bound by your halacha. So, I mean...
But he needs to justify Jews, right? He needs to justify declaring a Jewish boycott of this person. If the person did nothing wrong... That seems unjust.
Is this the only way that you can prove that he did something wrong?
Apparently.
There's other reasons to say, you can say you technically didn't do something wrong, but like it's not ro'oi for other reasons.
It's not ro'oi. So Jews are now we're going to impose the kibbutz if I did it on Jews.
Or you could, I don't know. I'm just wondering if there are other possibilities of saying that people should not buy from this other person besides saying that the goy was over our halacha.
No, I think you have to. I mean, I'm not saying there aren't any other, but I think the reason he feels like it's so problematic, like he really has to work hard to prove it, is because you can't just say it's like better. He can't say that it's better for Jews not to buy it because actually, really, like everyone would have much easier access to the work if they could buy the cheaper one. It would make them all. It would be like a whatever a matzah for everyone, right?
I don't understand. Couldn't you say that this
be
the? I don't know.
I think, look, part of the problem is the same problem that the U.S. has now enforcing its patents in other countries, right? Where it's against the interests of those countries to allow U.S. patents to be enforced, right? So we have all these countries in Asia who are break-stealing our patents, and the only time they start enforcing our patents is when they become advanced enough that they want to protect their own innovations as opposed to just steal ours.
It's not just that it's against the interest, but it's, like, against a whole line of collective thinking that we have that says what's better for the consumer that we allow. Right?
So, okay, we have to think about that, because what's better for the consumer, so that's, right, so the question is how that stands against Yori Lumanut, does that, right, do we think it's better for the consumer than Yori Lumanut?
Right, but I'm saying we have a whole line of thinking that says it's fine.
That's true. We also have to think that here, we never dealt with the question in the past, right, an economic perspective, that if we allow people to undercut the price, the result will be, right, the modern claim, right, if you allow people that will undercut innovation, right? That's the current American argument that, right? That you're undercutting innovation if you allow people to sell generic drugs at the same rate. So that there was no issue of innovation in any of the cases in the Gemara. So there was no long term cost to consumers.
That's not explicit. I don't think he's being explicit here about innovation either. I think you could say, couldn't you say the same thing for what like the Rumigash is talking about? That no one's going to bother to make a good product if someone can just come in and...
You could. I don't know that he addresses the question of what happens if the... We could raise the question that even in his scenario, there could be circumstances in which the result of the short-term drop in the market is long-term scarcity.
Right.
And I suspect that if he had raised the issue of the Rumigash and he had recognized that it was true, he would have said, okay, my principle doesn't apply here because that's not really benefiting the consumers. But I think that was a very sophisticated move, which didn't happen so rarely, and all of a sudden here you have a case where it's really very clear that the consequence of allowing copyright infringement is people will stop putting in that work, unless they have captive markets. But I say this is exactly the same problem, I think, as U.S. patent enforcement in developing countries, where the only thing you can do is raise them to the level where they have an interest in protecting their own innovations. Otherwise they'll just go on stealing your patents or your movies, right? Right, try and stop them from bringing iPads to the movie and filming it and then putting it on YouTube. Yes, Judith.
I guess I'm still just like stuck on how I feel like there's a fundamental flaw in saying like how are people buying an argument that a goy who had never learned our halacha is bound by it, and how people are seeing that as a legitimate way of blocking someone else from... I mean, like,
that's...
I don't know, I just feel you can say that you should buy from the Jew because he was the one who did it, and we also want to support Jewish livelihoods and whatnot, but to say that someone else, that a non-Jew was over our law, which he never knew about, never accepted, and therefore it's also... It doesn't seem like that the argument really follows.
So that's another fair way of question is, suppose you didn't think the non-Jew had done something slimy.
So
right,
it was
just a violation of halacha, it wasn't slimy.
Yeah.
Would he write this trivia? Would we feel any sympathy for it? Or is it just because he needs a technical way to say the non-Jew violated halacha, so he's found a technical way to say it, but really the fundamental thing is he did something slimy, he shouldn't get away with it.
Okay, fine.
This is like pretty, I think, the last question, right? There are lots of times that rabbis encourage their community members to only patronize Jewish businesses.
That's an ongoing question. Should you pray? Should you?
Yeah. No, I'm saying, and like, depending on how you react to that, to such an injunction.
Yes. Although here, this particular argument is saying patronize Jewish businesses because non-Jewish businesses are doing something usher.
Right. I'm saying that's why the argument is.
Also, it has to be a Jewish business. There's no like, this guy's not opening up a competing Jewish business. He's just taking, like, he can't offer anything new. Right, it's not like he can offer.
Well, he could. I mean, Bamberg opened up, right? You know, you could, non-Jews could hire Jews to produce competitive works, and and the whole issue was that the Maharam Fadua decided to open up his own business instead of taking a non-Jewish partner in, and you could just say the economic consequence is going to be that whenever Jews go into printing, they'll have to.
He didn't have a
non-Jew.
He had
a different non-Jewish partner.
Right.
So Jews. So you just say yes. Yeah. So Jews are just caught in the middle. That happens. Happens. Joshua, what do you want to say?
I want to say that, like, reading the law school review, they're talking about how, you know, at the beginning of the century, Venice had 120 printing houses.
Yes.
And a century later, they're only at 70 because they're experiencing all of this ruinous competition. It's going to go down from 70 to 40. Like, this is a market where people really are jumping over each other and putting each other out of business.
Yeah, that happens. How many bookstores did we have in the U.S. in 1985? How many do we have now?
Oh, so I was thinking, the question we're going to have is, like, or you can say, you know, am I dealing with Walmart, where I'm unhappy that they're competing? Or am I dealing with Uber, where I'm really happy they're coming
so
in?
So it's found out Uber at the Shabbos table. But if you have three, you have Walmart, you have Uber, you have Amazon.
Where do you think Amazon falls out?
Amazon wipes out all the independent bookstores.
But it replaces them.
Pardon?
But it replaces them.
But it also has a Napa, a Mississippi.
So Amazon, you know, so this is we talk about, right? The whole question is, right? Is it someday when Amazon has its actual monopoly, is it all of a sudden going to raise prices?
No.
Just been engaging in a 15-year, right? And, you know, and the drones will be converted from deliveries to.
Part of Amazon's power is marketplace.
Part of Amazon's power is that it is a marketplace.
That it's like there's more than one seller. There is Amazon selling products. It also sells other people's products.
Yeah, so it could be right. So it could be that Amazon, in essence, has just perfected a quasi-governmental structure.
Well, it's constricting and flattening the world of selling.
But
there are also plenty of local booksellers who like make their living off selling nationally via Amazon.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
There simply aren't the same bookstores there used to be. Just aren't. The whole experience of going and browsing used bookstore just doesn't exist anymore the way it did.
Okay.
In 2004,
that's a compelling moral argument.
There was 37,500, and nowadays there is 24,000.
I can't possibly go to like the Frick Museum in Philadelphia, or whatever it is. I'm not going to be able to go there and make my little appointment as an art student to go there some afternoon and have a private tour. I can possibly that they broke the will, which was illegal, but like the fact that that same experience doesn't exist is irrelevant.
Yeah, could be. I miss it, personally.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't disagree, but it's irrelevant. It's not a legal question.
So, I think that's... okay, so let's go back to our legal question is... Well, the underlying question is, does Rama really have a legal question? Is that really what he's approaching? Or does he have a justice problem? Or does he have an economic problem? For which the only tools he has are legal, so he has to turn it into an... Right, he has a hammer, so he has to turn it into a nail. Right, yes, Elliot.
So this, I think, is a question, but based on what Judah asked, right? One of the reasons he might have to turn this into a legal discussion is there's a lot less force, I think, in saying, you know, you shouldn't buy from that sure people, you should patronize local Jewish businesses, you should break in that. That's just, those are just moralistic claims that have a lot less weight than saying you're going to be put in cherem if you don't do that. And the only way you can say you're going to be put in cherem is you buy from him is if you make this into a legal claim. The only way you have a true force behind something, I think, Don might feel, and I think what's going to be true, is if you make a strong legal ruling about it, and not just the moralistic language that we want.
Okay, right, so it's not going to work unless he makes a legal claim. On the other hand, so if he doesn't have a legal claim, so be honest, you don't have a legal claim.
No, but he might have a legal claim, it just doesn't start out that way.
Uh-huh. Yes, Tova.
Two questions. One is more like technical, but if you're the average Jew in Padua, like what is your relationship to the Ramah? What's your relationship to the Ramah?
I don't know.
According to the article you read, the Sinai Dechem was pretty powerful in Poland, but then took the Ramah in Padua a lot of work to get the people to extend it to Italy, so it eventually happened.
Okay,
Choose an answer. Do we think that this, you'd have the same
tshuva
if it was a Jew who had done the thing?
I don't know. It could argue reasonably that what's going on here is something terrible is being done to the Maran Padua. Right, here's a great Talmid Chacham, and he spent a lot of time working on something which was a public good, and he's not charging extortionist prices, and besides, it's not a public necessity. People don't want it, then don't take it. Right, and his reward for this is because somebody is taking vengeance on him, right? And they are engaging in predatory pricing. Now you could suggest that the Maran Padua was unwise to invest himself so heavily in one ship, right? You know, that he should have had a balanced portfolio. He should have spread the risk. He should have spread subscriptions, things like that. And that's a whole challenge. I don't think there are, and I think that that's the whole issue nowadays, right? To what extent do we hold people accountable? Well, you shouldn't have put that much money into it. Yes, Jenna.
But I'm not sure how much I like that argument here. Like, I think that applies in a situation where you're working on something and it's possible someone else is working on it in parallel and you put a lot of time in it and someone else comes out first and, like, that sucks for you. I think it doesn't matter how little or much time he puts into something or how many different things that he does, someone can always come and steal it. That's not, you know?
Well, not going to steal it if you can just be a second late.
Okay, whatever. Yeah, but I mean, it's not that like if he had put his eggs in more baskets, he would be losing less. Because theoretically, anything he tries to publish, this other publisher can come and print it for less and take it out from under him.
So you think it's a generic problem although in this case, they're not claimed. In this case, we're dealing with predatory pricing.
Right.
Right. That it sounds like. So let's frame. There are a whole bunch of ways which we can talk about what's odd about this case, or what's unique about this case. One is, there is a great Talmid Chacham going to go broke. But you know what? At the end of the day, the great Talmid Chacham could have produced the Edsel. Have you anything to you guys?
The Edsel was amazing.
Right, the Edsel is the car, right? You put...
It was
amazing.
It was not a good car.
Okay. It could have produced, what was the last horrible movie that had hundreds of million dollars go into it?
Transformers 4.
Okay, whatever. It used to be, right, the Warren Beatty movie was the one which turned out not to be so horrible, supposedly, but that was like the...
Like, right about the football player?
No, well, let's say Howard the Duck.
Sure.
Howard the Duck was awful.
Howard the Duck, right, was like, that's the first, like, super...
I don't know,
it's a movie that cost a lot of money and then bombed.
Really great people can put tons of money into something. At the end of the day, if the Ram's edition of the Rambam had been a terrible edition... He would have lost all his money.
Latest Indiana Jones movie.
Oh, okay. Nobody could make...
Okay,
right.
What's the argument?
No, so it is, you can't protect him from everything.
That's the greatest movie.
You can't...
In essence, a terrible
movie. So in the end, right, so it turns out... So I say, but it can't be that we always protect Talmid Chacham from the consequences of their actions, because you can't. Like, he put that much money in, he took a risk. There's not anything we can do to stop that risk. We're not going to say that whenever a great Talmid Chacham puts out a book, everyone has to buy it. We do try to, whatever, a moderate Talmid Chacham puts out a book and comes around selling it, we try and tell people to buy it. But right, but if somebody, you know, puts out a gold-plated Rambam and it turns out his edition is horrible, and, right, and...
Is this extant?
I assume that we have copies.
Okay.
Yes, Clint. So we can't just be that, right? But it is certainly relevant to him that there is a great Talmid Chacham who has put this in. Then there's a second issue, which is a fair competition issue. That we have here is a case where A, the pricing will drive someone out of business, and B, the pricing is deliberately set up to drive the other person out of business. Right? The second edition is being advertised as a gold coin less than the other edition.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That is the... by the way... This right, you know, this is also, if you want, like the recent case, the recent version of this is the traditional press Talmud, which was the Sansino Talmud reprinted, and was sold much cheaper, right? And that was right. So this still happens.
And a lot of Rabbanim in New York tend to not to buy the still only buy Sansino.
Yes.
And a few people listened.
Yeah.
And then a few people went around to people's houses and threw out their remarks.
At some point, a rip-off edition of Sansino's English translation was put out.
And Sansino was still under copyright, or wasn't?
For some reason, I imagine, there must have been a way that Sansino couldn't enforce it.
Okay.
So that issue came out. There was also an issue like that.
Because it was England against America, right? That was, they didn't have any form of
international
copyright.
There was no treaty then. Right? And this similar thing, but then either what happens if you think that they're charging exorbitant prices because they have a monopoly? And it's in the public interest, right? That's which, to some extent, I think, is what happened with Bar-Ilan at one point, which is why Bar-Ilan prices are different than America and Israel.
Yeah. I was going to say, the arguments you're making are the same for all new technologies, that they will drive out old things. So, like, if people can argue that Ultra Chachma is driving out Judaica stores.
But it's... it's driving out to technology and making a better product,
right.
Then
yeah.
It's just the capacity... Right, there's a challenge, right, you know, what we would do halakhically if we really think iPhones are better than anything else, but we also think that Apple is charging, right, 15 times what a reasonable profit margin on iPhones, and we think iPhones are a public good. Right? Would we authorize a rip-off iPhone? But like I said, iPhones are crazy. We do this with medicine.
Right.
Right. If we think that medical profits are too high, that's when we start authorizing generics, and we have this constant negotiation going on with pharmaceutical companies. So. Torah is a different kind of public good than medicine?
You said Torah, right, Robert? I'm hoping everyone caught that.
iPhone equals Torah.
Okay, hang on a sec. There was a... Avi, you had your hand up before. No? Hi, Em.
This isn't a case of predatory pricing. Like, these people, the price, they're going to keep the price... Maybe they're going to keep the price as it is, and they have less expensive because they're copying someone else's work.
No.
Well, there are two kinds of predatory pricing. One is, obviously, three kinds of predatory pricing. One is, you just wait for the other guy's work and you rip it off, so you don't have the costs of production. And in general, it's just much easier to reverse engineer, right, than to produce the original. The second is predatory pricing, where my sole purpose is to drive the other person out of business, not because I want to raise prices afterwards, I just don't want the other guy in business.
That's what it says, right?
Which is what he's doing here. And the third is predatory pricing with the intent of raising the price. So we don't have any hint that he's raising the price, but he is planning to sell it till, right? His goal is to stop anyone from buying the Maran Padua's edition. Until at some point, probably, he might be very happy if Maran Padua says, look, here's all my edition at cost. And then he'll sell his edition too. But I think, right? But, so there are a lot of reasons that this is a bad company, right? This is a special case, right? There's a Thomas Hacham involved, there's real bankruptcy, there is something that intuitively anyone can look at it and say, oh my goodness, that's not fair.
But intuition is not a halakhic principle.
I don't know, then we go back to Avi, maybe.
But there has to be some rational reason.
There's a rational reason. We shouldn't let people rip stuff off.
But are you saying that halakha is based on mostly morality? And
not mostly. I think if I'm approaching this case, and I would walk up to anyone on the street and say, so-and-so put several years of work into this, and then, right, and then somebody else came along and took all his work, and used it for profit, we would say, that's wrong. Now we could say in response, no, you know what? The Maram was wrong, because you shouldn't be thinking about Tzvarim as a source of profit.
That is a good argument.
I mean, I don't know. I think people are saying that, like, a morality-based halacha is problematic. You said a few weeks ago.
Yes.
So, I mean, here, and while I'm sympathetic to say that intuitively we have to care about people's businesses, we can't base halacha, at least Rosh Mishpat, purely on morality.
No, we can't.
So, what...
I think but I was pointing out that there are, this is a case of first impression, really. And this is really the first copyright case we have. Printing is a new technology. The notion of making money by keeping intellectual capital to your, right, by having a legal right to protect your intellectual property is not a regnant notion.
But we're not even necessarily talking about making money, right? So far, the only thing we have to be talking about this time is just not losing money.
Because it takes an investment to print things, and if you don't sell them out, you lose money.
Right.
And
no one's yet mentioned anything about making a profit.
It's presumed. The Maran Padua isn't going out printing this just for funsies.
Well, it could be he's just trying to break even, right?
Right, it could be he's trying to break even. I mean, that's how all academic work now, and that's why they're so ridiculously expensive. But just to break even, they have to sell a few, and that's all they expect to sell.
Sell 50 copies.
Well, sell to every academic library also.
Right.
Yeah, so academic libraries exist in many ways to make... Right,
just to let people publish academic things so that they can break even.
Yeah. So that's it. I think that's... Right, but I think that the underlying question you have to address is, really, to what extent is there... Whenever you bail somebody out... Right, so what you're doing is you are diminishing the moral risk. Right, they took a chance. Right, why should everybody else be right? Why should everybody else be obligated to bail them out of that chance? So here we could look at the Maran Padua and say, "Wow, you overextended yourself. what people will learn from this is that you should not put so much money of your own into a printed edition of something, because, you know what, again, because no matter what he did, it could very well have been that in the next town, somebody else was working on a better edition, and he would be stuck. But he assumed that he knew the whole market. Right? Now, maybe that was right. Maybe he said, look, I know, in all of Western Europe, I know all the major printers, and if any of them were working on an edition, they would have told me. So I know that I have this market, and it was not an unwanted, and I know what the, and I'm confident I know what the market for Mishnah Torahs is. Right? It could very well be. I don't know the answer to that. But we couldn't have stopped everything. But here, it happens that the person who did it really just took his work and then engaged in predatory pricing. So it's not unreasonable for somebody to say, wow, this is where the world is going. If I don't stop this, right? So then this whole world of intellectual property is going to be a jungle. And we need to create some kind of law about this, because printing requires enormous capital investment in ways that change the economic environment. And we want to encourage people to produce better editions. Okay, yes, Yaakov.
What you're saying isn't crazy, but it seems to be very focused on this specific case. I mean, the case was Maharam Parua approached this person said he didn't want to do it, then when the Maharam Parua went off to do his own thing, the person went and used the Maharam Parua's actual notes and had it in the back and told everyone why it was wrong, and so that's, and the Maharam Parua was going broke, so like, I don't know how much we can extend this Ramah into the future of all copyright infringement law ever.
Right, so that is the challenge when you have cases, right, when you have this case. This was a great opportunity to establish copyright law because no one was going to argue in this case that it shouldn't happen. Right? Or is it, look, copyright law's got to go into this, but at some point it gets so ridiculous somebody has to say something. I don't know which one it is. Yes, Joshua.
So you've been saying that because of the particulars of this case, this might be an easy one to say, you know what, I really know how the law should go in this case. There's a saying like in legal circles, like
hard cases
hard
make bad
cases
law.
Make
yes.
Bad law. I think you're suggesting that easy cases make bad law.
I'm not saying bad or good law. Just saying that.
But like, what maybe I should flesh out, the danger might be that this case had so many factors that are external to the stated legal arguments that made it particularly clear that it would be bad law to apply those legal categories to cases that don't line up.
Yes.
As nicely.
So I think that there.
So easy cases make bad law.
In a sense, yeah. I think that there was a there's a strong tendency to declare something as law here because the result is untenable the other way. Right. So when the result is untenable, so you're going to make weaker arguments, or more sweeping, or arguments whose implications you wouldn't take in other cases, just because it just can't be in the end. It can't be that one person can take someone else's work and rip it off and sell it and drive the other person to bankruptcy, and they come to Beit Din and we say, I really wish we could help you. But we can't. Yes?
Is there an argument to say that being as the first case dealing with this, they made mistakes and we can't really learn from this case?
And we could also say that it was just just not a great tshuva.
Yeah. I mean, because it's a band-aid thing, because we've never dealt with this before. We don't know how to deal with this. But so,
it's the wrong
one. Yes, Jan.
Do you have any indication that he cares about what this does about future copyright? I mean, maybe all he cares about is the specific situation where Tommy's going to come and printing work.
So we don't know. We don't know. The rest of us care. Right? What he intended, we don't know. Now he gets here, right? His specific argument, right? Once he has to pull a very, very fancy move to get to the point that halacha matters at all, right? But having demonstrated that halacha matters at all, then he has to pull one more move, and he has to say that the Mordechai quoting the Avi Asaf doesn't hold like Rav Huna, so he can paskin like the Avi Asaf, even though he paskins against Rav Huna. And then he has to introduce a new category called Bari Hezeka. Now, in order to introduce Bari Hezeka, what he has to do is he has to abstract the Rav Yoz case of the Mavoi, right, of the Mavoi with only one entrance, because that's a physical case. Right, he abstracts that to any case where you know that opening your business is going to seriously damage someone else's business. And that's a huge step. That's a huge step, because in the case of the Mavoi, the point was, right, the point of the case of the Mavoi was that your products are indistinguishable. Right? But you're just creating a circumstance where nobody will choose your product over theirs. In a sense, you're seizing a convenience advantage, which you have no particular right to, a very brief, right? It seems to be a trivial convenience advantage, right? It's a matter of two steps for people. They'll just never get past your store to his store. But here, that's not really the... a Bari Hezekah, that's not really fair, because Bari Hezekah, if I produce a better product, then it's Bari Hezekah. Right? Uber is Bari Hezekah on taxis, perhaps. Amazon is Bari Hezekah on small bookstores. Cars are Bari Hezekah on
horseless carriages.
Yes. So when the Ramah says, right, so we're taking a look at now on page five, is it? Five. Right, when he says that Yesod HaPashto Rishon of Perek Lo Yachbor, and he quotes Rav Huna, and then he says, even though the Rish passing against Rav Huna, nonetheless, we say the Kol Makom Meron Yishyesh LeShev Badar, and he quotes the Mordechai about the Mavi with three sides. He says, right, which seems to imply that since he passed like Rav Huna, the is like him. So how do we deal with this? We passed like Rav Huna against Rav Huna. Solution is El Al Kain Tzrichman L'Chalek the B'davar D'Bari Hezekah. He goes Hafa Gabi Mavi Shavada Yaziklo Kuli Alma Modu D'Hilchos Sek Rav Huna. He came nearly done Nami Bari Hezekah. Why? Ki Hayentel Amar Hasheni Natan Lachris Shakol Sefer Yozil Zvuv Tfei Mehagon Umira Azot Leavoy Lo Lekosimenu B'yakol Hu Lozil Kume Ashirei Haaretz. So he complicates his argument because he says it's Bari Hezekah, but in the end the grounds for Bari Hezekah is predatory pricing, and he doesn't disentangle those arguments. Because the question is, if we want, right, what do we think about a case where the reason it's Bari Hezekah is not because the price of the other person is artificially lower, because the price of the other person is naturally lower. Hmm. Yes, then.
Why can't it just be that you're setting up a situation in which everyone, like there would be no reason to go to the other
seller,
right?
Yes. So if I had better quality, there's no reason anyone to go to the better seller.
Right.
So does the Ramah think that, would the Ramah issue a restraining order against me for producing a better mousetrap? The intent to stifle innovation.
Right, if there's absolutely no... Yeah, if there's absolutely...
I see. So I think those two factors need to be disentangled, and he doesn't disentangle them.
Because if you invent a better mousetrap that's not based on the other person's mousetrap, and even if the competition would be...
So I'll give you a case. Okay, let's suppose, and this is very close to a real case. Let's suppose that there is somebody who has made a business out of getting scholarship money for yeshiva day school students. Right, they have done tons of research on the internet, federal government, right, and they know how to do it, and so they've run a business that all the day school students in the Massachusetts area come to them, and in exchange for 5% of the gross, right, they take you through all these websites and all the applications, and they get the money. And then somebody wealthy in the community says, why should all these students be paying 5%? And they look at the grants the other person's gotten, and they reverse engineer the process. Maybe they talk to people, right? They figure out the other person has relationships with admissions officers, so they call those admissions officers, and this wealthy person in the community now opens as a public service. He is going to provide the same service that first person did for 1%. So what do you think we should do?
Well, did providing the service really cost the guy anything in the first place?
Time. He invested his time, right? And this was his parnasa.
I'm saying, do we view time as a...
He gained specialized knowledge, right? He has specialized knowledge that is useful to everybody, and then somebody else who doesn't need the money discovered that it's easy to reverse engineer the knowledge.
So what's he gaining out of this person?
Nothing. He's just doing a mitzvah.
Who cares? Right. So what, you want to pay him a sar zehuvim? Like, what do you, what's he losing by the second guy doing this?
Oh, he loses his whole parnasa. This first guy, this whole parnasa was right. His whole parnasa was helping yeshiva students get
parnasa.
You get a parnasa by helping people. Right, what's the problem? Right, but it's like grant writing. Right, lots of people make their money with grant, right, through grant writing with foundations. And what happens if somebody rich decides to offer? You know, why should these yeshivas pay money to grant writers? I will reverse engineer all the skills these grant writers have, and I'll write the same grants for free. Yes, Avino.
Well, I mean, part of what makes this a difficult case is we have the explicit tachana for education, so it may not be. Meaning, we may want to encourage more people to be educated. Even we may allow competition that otherwise would not be allowed.
Education? This is not Torah education.
It's to allow people to get scholarships.
Scholarships to college.
Yeah, but if it's Jewish children, according to the Rambam.
Oh, is that? Aha.
Yeah, I thought it was Jewish high school. But even if it's college.
Let's suppose it's a service to let
cheap airport tickets. Suppose you are better than Dan Steele's in charge. Suppose Dan, there's some guy who did Dan Steele's, but they charge.
Yeah.
And then Dan's
funny.
Like, I can do this.
But if you're going to Israel.
Yeah, right. So, like, we just, I think we very, I mean, maybe this is a very American idea, which is that let the innovator win, you know, as our reason this car.
Well, is it, so there's two kinds of, one is an innovator, and the other is we just reverse engineer the other person.
Well, the question is, this is, I think, a great case of, like, where we apply the perhaps misnaming Stina de Machatazina, and that is that if we can claim intellectual property infringement, then do so, and if not, don't.
Right, we could say this is trade secrets, and trade secrets, as long as you don't obtain them nefariously, right? That's right. What's the big deal?
Same,
yes.
With, like we have with like, what is it, Apple and Samsung?
Yeah.
Where like Samsung just like takes Apple phones and is like, we can do this, and then like,
yes.
It. And so
right.
Apple is like, no, you kind of can't.
Because we distinguish very sharply between patents and trade secrets. Patents are actual innovations which we care about defending, and trade secrets we say tough. Try to protect them. If you fail, you fail.
Depends on. I don't know if it's such a sharp distinction.
I think it is. I think it's a very sharp distinction. Yes, Elliot.
So, yeah, I sort of don't see... I agree that trade secrets don't have nearly the same protection. I don't know if they should, as patents and real innovation, but I would say this might be the Nimuka Yosef and others in me, but there's a big difference in the two ways you phrase the question with Avinoam versus how you set out, because in the way you said that, now I'm going to charge 1%.
Yeah.
And without knowing, you said, oh, this really what person is going to do it for free.
Uh-huh.
That's very different.
You think it matters?
I think free, you can clearly say this is predatory pricing, and that it is truly just to get rid of this guy's pranasa.
But he's not trying to get rid of it. He thinks the guy's pranasa is based on
right.
unfairly fleecing issues.
Right,
student.
But if he charged 1% or 2%, versus 5%, you could say, oh, he's just kind of saying that 5% is too high, and this is unfair fleecing. If he's charging, if he's making it free, then you can say, then there's much more of a claim that this is very different.
You can make the argument like the other way, right?
I'm not sure I'm convinced that it goes that way. Trade Seeker, for example, is using a silver knife and stirring backwards to produce whatever potion it is. The instructions of the half-blood prince. Right? Those are trade secrets. They're not patents. You're not producing anything new. Right? But you have a process that anyone could do that lets you do something better. You wrote the book. Friend?
The
patent process is
uh-huh.
In England?
Here?
Yes.
It's in England.
Yes.
But that's why we have... I think it depends on what the market looks like, right? It's like I think in general people think that giving long patents to pharmaceutical companies... is against the greater good. Whereas, because like we think pharmaceutical companies, big pharma makes a lot of money, and so there's no need to protect them. They're always going to make a little bit of money, even if they only have their drug for a year before before the generic comes out, which is fine. I think a case of where not many people are printing books, and this is one guy's direct friend of that. I don't think you can even compare the two.
So let's pull it back down again. What I think the intuition most of us will have, but is that Bari Hazeka by itself is not enough. Because Bari Hazeka is un-American. Yes, every time you innovate, right, there's a benefit to consumers, and that seems to be against the Remigash. And Remigash has a benefit to consumers, go ahead. And it seems to be against the whole school of Ramban claim that quality, and even in the Tosfos, that quality makes a difference. So what on earth is the... could you possibly frame as an issue here? But on the other hand, if it was just the question of somebody undercutting, but it wouldn't really affect the other person's business much, so you might say, okay, there's still a benefit to consumers. So what we're looking for is some kind of sweet spot where a Bari Hazeka meets predatory pricing. Yes, Jacob.
I don't know if... I just thought of this, so I don't know how true it is, but he kind of contradicts himself later in the tshuva when he says that by stopping the selling of the competitors' new Rambams, it won't actually cause him to lose because he'll start working harder for when he can actually sell them. When the Maharam sells out his first printing, he'll start working harder to sell them. So if that guy, could that guy claim that it was a Bari Hazeka that he suffered and yet the Rambam says he will go back and just sell better?
He
printed 100 copies of it, and now he has to wait for 5 years until Maram sells out his 5,000 copies that he printed, and that's a loss of investment. And yet,
I don't care. But the Maram came first. There's no Bari Hazeka. The second guy doesn't matter to me. The second guy trying to delay the Maram. But you're right. You have to pick out one of the big factors here is that he has no interest in. And this is one of the features of halakhic copyright issue. He doesn't, right, the Ramad doesn't really think about protecting his intellectual property. Right, Ramad doesn't think about protecting a second printing. Right, what he's protecting about is the first printing, and that's very odd because the amount of investment Ramad put in terms of his labor, right? Suppose Ramad only printed 5 copies, that's only worth, right? What we do now with the copyright would say is if it's sold out, go print a second edition. Right, what he's doing is he's taking the model. The model is still one where people show up with a fixed price of a commodity, and when they sell out, other people will have the market. And it's just a question of who sells first and at what price. So that may not be a viable economic model. It may just not work. Yes.
In the globalized market.
Yes.
I have worked on the second printing usually makes more money than the first.
So this is a whole right economic shift. So that comes down to the two biggest points. Right? One is, should there be halakhic copyright legislation? How copyright legislation functions should be a function of market and technology. Right? And the answer, the best copyright legislation may very well depend on all sorts of factors. For example, copyright protection is much less important when you have a system where you have university professors who get paid to teach, and the only reason to put out the book is to get promoted. You're not planning to make any money off the book. Right? So when you have a system which is when you have a system where the people who produce books don't make their money from the books. Right? Nowadays, right, so the model if you self-publish, you're not supposed to make money from the books, you're supposed to make money from the speeches you give promoting the books. Right? It's a whole different model. Now each of these models, now you have print on demand. So it doesn't take any kind of initial investment at all.
Those don't get you promoted.
Those don't get promoted, right? So we have a whole bunch of different markets. We have an academic market where the book can sell 2 copies and no one cares in the slightest. First of all, you do have libraries, right? You have a built-in market, right? And B, really, the whole goal is to get a couple of purists to review you because that's your market for promotion, right? There's a whole separate thing. So the question is, what do we do? Is there any point in setting up a quote-unquote halacha about issues which are best determined by economic circumstances, or do we abandon it one way or the other? Do we say the best way to do it is to figure out the din of malchusa is better, the best way to do it is to say we'll make Takanos when the time comes, or can we try and muddle through by saying that we buy Din and Malchus Adina, except we have enough first principles that we won't allow a really horrible Din and Malchus Adina, and we're always worried about the particular circumstance, which is what happens when the government makes a wise policy for the general population, which is bad for the Jews. Yes, Tova.
I also think it's important to consider like the practical, like how enforceable halacha is. Like, it doesn't make any sense to make a halacha that no one can listen to.
Yes.
So don't, like, pirating music, maybe.
So that's fair also, right? To make, right, to, in general, we think it's a bad idea to make laws that people don't follow.
Yeah, particularly for halacha.
So pirating music, it's a bad idea to legislate things, particularly if you have no enforcement power to legislate
yeah.
things. That no, and this is my argument always, which raises a whole firestorm and talks other time about dress codes. Right? I never think there's any point in imposing dress codes that people don't buy into. Right? Because you don't have any, right? You don't want to be in a situation. Nobody wants to keep enforcing a law that no one really believes is true, right? Is a good idea. No matter what you think the right law should be, it doesn't work. Yes.
But I sort of think that the fact that I think we've been in this situation where we've had, you know, we can't enforce these laws, so there's no point in making them. And then we lose a whole aspect of Torah law. So that to say we shouldn't make these laws in this case because they will never be applied means that we're just because through not that decision we'll lose all of.
Right. So we're back to the question of right, what does it mean to reclaim Chosh Mishpat?
The thing I would say is there a way to even if we don't have the Messiah and can't apply it for the Messiah, can we develop the first principles that might govern how we see any copyright case?
Okay, but any copyright case or any copyright case in the 21st century in North America?
That's hard, because how do you separate our analysis of first principles from the Argentinian?
Yes, I just think the notion that you can work, the notion that you can develop consistent laws of property across capitalist and socialist economies seems to be very problematic. How do you do that? Yes, Tova.
I also wonder if we ought to think about what they call it, the shift from a goods economy to a service economy.
Yeah.
So their mind is like 100% operating in a goods economy, and so like what you can produce. And so there, I think perhaps the Yerei Imnitavirao principle might have to be reframed in a service-oriented economy.
Yes, no, I think that's really true. He's thinking about books.
He's thinking about like physical books.
Right, he's thinking about books,
we're
right.
We're
thinking about the book. Right, so it's a very different. Okay, last thing I want to just ask is, how does our right, assuming that Professor Netanel's description is correct, how is our evaluation of this tshuva affected by the apparent judgment that it was among the most disastrous things ever?
Sorry,
it was disastrous practically.
Okay.
Right, and he has a throwaway line. Oh, there's no issue of Yishumeva.
right.
And if you read the article, right, this was, you know, yes, this was the paradigmatic Eva case.
Can you write a response that we have?
Who wrote a response?
Roma.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, really.
I don't know.
Well,
like, just kidding, Eva does apply for Mechas on
Empire. Except that,
my bad.
He does take a much, it seems like much more lenient approach in his glasses on the Shulchan Aruch.
So if you think the Shulchan Aruch is a response to, oh my goodness, I blew that, right? You can.
Well, it's a trend in Rishonim to say Eva doesn't apply when we have a good excuse.
Yeah.
Maybe they should be careful with that trend.
Right.
Yes, super.
Look at the article. The Rama was really, really young when he wrote this.
And
it's
so,
the best judgment.
So it's just a mistake. So we'll write this other article, which I can put out that. That David Nimmer wrote about the Maram Benet, where he made the same mistake. And tried to shut down something in a case for the non-Jew involved and got completely squashed. And 10 years later is writing a very, very different tshuva. Yeah. So that's a whole question about whether right, do we are people's halachic authority diminished by their poor practical judgment? Do we learn lessons from this that the whole attempt to try and construct a halacha that really functions in a mixed economy is a mistake? Because ultimately Christ can't do it, or it has to be done on different presumptions than it was previously.
The tshuva as itself, parts of it aren't very convincing.
Right, so we can say, you know what, this is just a regrettable tshuva.
Yeah.
Wait, what if?
So what if it's Simon Yudin Tshuva?
Wait.
Okay. Yes, Aviyah.
I
I mean, I think this is a great test case for changing realities, because, like, he's relying on a Tosfa that, you know, Justiniani will never be angry. So, like, he apparently didn't know the Tosfa that he wouldn't be angry. Like, you can't assume the reality is what the sources tell you it's going to be.
We can write other Truvot about how Justiniani is now in violation not only of but he ignored a Tosfa. All right. Yes, Joshua.
It seems that Justiniani, it seems to be motivated by Ava to do all of these things. But also, we saw 3 years ago a different... the Taz says that Mishum Ava doesn't apply to Bishul Akum, but for very different reasons. Like, there he says, this is specifically an area of Halakha where decreasing Ava is not a concern. But here the Ramah seems to be saying that, oh, Mishum Eva doesn't apply, therefore we can project as a public policy that we could reasonably expect him not to become angry.
Rav Kook thought...
Totally different.
Rav Kook thought you could explain to non-Jews why you wouldn't say them on Shabbos.
Abaye
thought that, yeah.
Yes.
Abaye
thought that. Yeah, but I don't...
And Abaye probably could.
I don't know. I don't know. I'm not sure that was ever realistic. Yes, Jenna.
I mean, I don't think that backfired in a very particular way is any... I mean, okay, so maybe it discounts that exact part of the tshuva for that exact historical moment, but I don't know. I think maybe I've watched too many underdog movies, but just because they're mean to you doesn't mean you shouldn't try. Like, I think it doesn't mean he wasn't right, and I think if you bring it into this day and age, I don't think we're worried about anyone burning things. I mean, well, okay, that's not true. People burn places all the time. But, like, I don't think... Like, I think the bigger question is whether you're asking people to do something illegal, which is... Now I'm realizing I forgot to ask Professor Shingman my question of, like, is it illegal to tell a group of people not to buy things?
There are opinions about that, no, but the question is whether a private group could do it in order to restrain competition.
Right. That's the question. If it's not illegal, then I don't think there's any problem. I don't think in this day and age, I don't think we're worried in the same way that maybe he should have been.
I've got different opinions about that. I think it is, actually. If you tell them, if your purpose is restraining competition, if you tell people not to buy things for religious reasons, right, that's okay. If you tell people because you wish to restrain competition, it's probably illegal. And the question, and what happens if your religious reason is the desire to prevent competition, that would be a very challenging case.
It's preventing being a jerk.
I think it's different.
Okay, I think that's open. I am very torn about the question of whether a tshuva that is disastrous should automatically just be thrown out, because you know what? If it's disastrous...
In one very specific way.
Yeah.
He was wrong about Mishum Eva.
Right.
Yeah.
That was wrong, and we have to acknowledge that for now, but the other parts of the analysis, if we agree with them, or find them useful, we can use them, because that's not what he got wrong. He got wrong a specific aspect of Mishum Eva.
So the question I want to ask is whether we have to reconceptualize the whole question of the relation to the Jewish economy to the non-Jewish economy. Right? Well, this is an attempt to say, you know what, we can live in our own economy and they'll live in their economy and nobody will get mad because we understand that economically we live in different universes. And that was false. They saw themselves as living in the same... Right? This was a new circumstance in which there were non-Jews competing to sell to Jews in Jewish stuff. Right? And that, it didn't seem like there was a... It seems in retrospect like someone could have predicted, well, if they're competing to sell us stuff, they're going to get mad if we try and engage in unfair practices. So the question is, does that whole attempt to legislate ourselves as a separate part of the economy, as opposed to trying to develop a chosh mishpat that works for Jews and non-Jews in the economy as a whole, but is that a viable framework, or do we claim that any such distinctions nowadays inevitably lead to Eva? So there's no point, right? And let's say theoretically, let's suppose we could develop a whole chosh mishpat, right? But at the end of the chosh mishpat, there would be a sentence which said none of this applies nowadays mishum Eva, right? Would that be a useful enterprise? And if we take the position that any attempt to distinguish Jews and non-Jews on these grounds will lead to Eva, then that's just going to fail. So there's no point doing it. Okay. Yes. If.
This isn't even a case of Ava, right? Let's be fair.
Yeah.
This is a nut job with a vendetta. Right? That's not our general Mishu Ava.
Uh-huh.
It could be that the Ramos principle might hold true in circumstances of business where if there's no, you know, organized boycott and picketing and just like a consensus. So he might get annoyed. He might not print things for the Jewish community in the future, but he's not gonna go sick the church on them. Right? This is a guy who has a very, very large axe to grind.
So we are now playing this out in a lot of places between the Jewish and African American communities. That on the one hand, we get very upset if people want to not buy from the Jewish businesses in the area because they want to build their own business. And on the other hand, we still have a notion of buying Jewish, and we're still working out in America the extent to which economic, right, build, you know, the extent to which is it reasonable that all the taxi drivers in New York City are from the same country, and all the convenience store owners in Detroit are from the same country, and all the peddlers are from the same country, and we have the, right, the fights going on with the kosher and halal hot dog carts, right, or shawarma carts going on in New York, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, there's all sorts of fights like that because those are all monopolistic businesses. I think there are two fundamental challenges to trying to make anything, trying to build a chosh and mishpat that is internal, that works on purely internal dynamics. One is economies change dramatically, not just over time, but from place to place. And I say to me that the simple thing is really trying to come to consistent halacha across the boundaries between a totally free, laissez-faire, fair free marketplace and a socialist place seems very difficult. And the second is that the relationships with non-Jews change dramatically. And when we're dealing with halacha that is designed to deal with an economy that integrates Jews and non-Jews, so it makes an enormous difference if you're dealing with an economy in which the Jews and non-Jews are obviously have antagonistic interests, in which Jews and non-Jews are expected to live as separate competing spheres, but the competition is legitimate, and spheres in which we expect that everyone functions as an individual in the economy, and the notion of functioning as a group is morally problematic to everybody. Okay, yes, Tova.
I mean, we can create a system of regulations only if we also provide the incentive system, right? Like, we can only make it unfair. We can only restrict competition or restrict business practices of Jews if we also provide the reward for doing so. Otherwise, no one has incentive to follow the law.
Isn't the reward following?
Well, if you buy Jewish, then
no.
They'll buy Jewish for you. But is it morally right?
Yeah, what?
Is it morally right?
Sorry?
Is it morally correct? That we are right, or conversely, is it inevitable Ava to try and set up an economic system that sets Jews apart in a system which treats Jews as full equals?
I think there's what you want is a system that makes people, right, respect Jews. You want the, like, Gedolim stories. You want, like, a system of halachot that will make non-Jews
want to
do business with Jews
because
Jews are better businessmen.
Uh-huh.
No, I'm serious, though. What you want to do is create a system which lends the halachic individual the moral high ground. Otherwise, it's not going to succeed, first of all. And second of all, you're putting everyone at a disadvantage if it did succeed.
You have to give it a moral high ground. This should be the goal of our system.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about when this was established. I imagine that we're talking about an incredibly unregulated system. Telling Jews not to integrate other Jews' businesses seems like a pretty lofty principle. And then to enforce that, when you have the tools to enforce that, is incredible. It creates machlachat kohanim mikvei kadosh.
Uh-huh. Preventing us from competing with each other.
Yeah. What you're saying is that we strive to do better.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure what value a choshen mishpat has without that, especially when we have basically very well-functioning economic roles in laws and society.
Okay, last two comments. Yes, Shira Ellie.
So, like, my thinking right now is that it's hard to create a choshen mishpat that's enforceable in Beit Din or that's imposed on other people, but I'm wondering, going off of what Tova's saying, if there's an Indian of trying to sell the idea that, on the one hand, we can't necessarily enforce a Choshen Mishpat today. There's still value in asking shalos and Choshen Mishpat and being able, and, you know, someone who's Yerei Shamayim would ask a shalos when there's a possibility that they might be treading problematic grounds or something.
But are the problematic grounds halachic problematic grounds or moral problematic grounds? So
So we have to figure out what's, you know, but what defines halakhically problematic grounds in the realm of, so if somebody comes to you and says, am I allowed to download music without paying for it?
Right.
So, assuming it's not illegal, right? Do you want there to be halakhic tools?
You want halakhic tools? Well, if you can prove that halakha has something very correct to say about it, you don't have to necessarily like announce this rabbi and whatever. But if someone, but like, there should be a mechanism of someone being able to ask a question and being able to get an honest answer about it.
Uh huh. Okay. Ellie, last comment.
I'm just curious to know, when we say dina de mechusa dina, are we saying that when the non-Jewish government has an active hand in the market, or are we even saying that when there's anarchy or the government...
No, there has to be a dina de mechusa dina doesn't apply. In case of anarchy, there are just no rules.
How about libertarianism? We're just complete deregulation.
It's a complete deregulation, there'd be no rules either.
But
then we should distinguish, but you know, that might not be good government. It might not be... I mean, it might not be a competitive market, right? In Ted Rosenbaum's terms, a free market is not a competitive market. But in Akhenami, if you say Dina Malchus Adina, so then if the government lets you run free, then the government lets you run free.
But at that point, maybe Choshev Mishra should and could and should step in, because the Choshev Mishra has there is an opportunity for Jews to operate at a higher level.
So you want to say that we should fit the interstices of the economic system, where the economic system leaves gaps that we think should be regulated, so we can leave, right? We can stick halacha in. Okay, it's a pretty small thing, and then the government, you know, and the all your working just to be overridden tomorrow because the government can pass a law, and so you know, hours and hours spent writing tshuva just turn out to be irrelevant, because right, because the government passes a law.
Well, you have to unwrite
the tshuva,
right? Once they say something's halacha.
You have to unwrite
the same. Unless, you're saying part of the halacha.
Is Dina Mechus Adina.
Applies if.
Okay, good. We're going to break now. We shall resume at 3:30, I think. Is Roy Jester, who is here already? Okay. So it's not one of the most more scintillating shirts.